This is Phelan Lundeberg interviewing Bombardier Stan Oakes, formerly of the 1st Canadian Survey Regiment, on the 26th of January at the Quality Inn downtown Victoria. And first and foremost, Mr. Oakes, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
Okay. So what was the age that you enlisted?
19,
and you were originally in the Searchlight Battery?
That's correct.
Can you just briefly explain to me what your duties were there?
We had operated searchlights along the coast here in the Victoria Harbour, Fort Rod Hill and Macaulay Point and Black Rock, the front on the end of the breakwater. And our job was to man the searchlights, shine them across the harbour when the occasion arose to... The main objective was to prevent any unauthorized shipping from entering the harbors or whatever, if there was any threat at the time, Japanese or something.
Okay. And then you were, after a while, you were transferred into the
survey. I transferred of my own, I requested a transfer to the 1st Canadian Survey Regiment. I thought it was more in line with my experience and capabilities and education than that.
And was that relatively easy at the time to do?
Was it easy?
Mm-hmm.
As I recall, when I confronted my commanding officer, he asked me why, and I told him I thought my services would be more useful in the survey regiment. He didn't take too kindly to my suggesting that where I was wasn't important. But anyway, no, it wasn't difficult. I was granted a transfer.
And can you just briefly go over why you felt that you'd be better used in the survey regiment?
Well, I'd had 1 year in at Victoria College. I'd been up in my maths and trigonometry and one thing or another, and I was interested in this. Surveying, was an engineering-type activity which appealed to me. Mm-hmm. Rather than shining searchlights, was a pretty dull activity.
I can't imagine. So then, once you transferred, where did you do your initial training?
Well, we went to went down to Petawawa, and we didn't have much training there. This was basically an assembly point there. You know, the regiment was still being assembled and recruited. So, I guess I was what, two or three, couple of months in Petawawa, I guess, but didn't do much training there. Our main training was in England.
Mm-hmm.
We went to England, and we went to Lark Hill and Salisbury Plains, and we had about a 3 or 4 months survey course. Having had a year in at the college, I was a little advanced on some of the people I was because I had the math.
Mm-hmm.
But we learned how to use instruments and take survey and conduct traverses and locate ourselves from taking star observations and all the basics of surveying, and also to learn the techniques of eventually was flash spotting, which was a teamwork kind of thing. You had four posts, and you had to learn how to focus on a target. So that was a separate part. But basically, it was learning all the techniques of surveying, how to use an instrument and level it, and not fumble it, and not kick it over. That lasted about 4 months, roughly. And from there on in England, we were just on maneuvers and practicing with the artillery, and we were all over the south of England. I've listed all the names of quite a few places, but basically all over the south of England and Wales. We spent quite a bit of time in Wales. There was an artillery range in Brecon Beaconsfield. Very mountainous country, and so we worked with the artillery there.
And when we talked the other day, you were telling me that there was some problems with your kit, the equipment they gave you for the weather in England.
Well, I guess the main thing was that we were in pretty short of rain gear, and that, you know, it rains a lot over there, so you got used to being wet. the rain gear we had and was not very adequate. And, of course, we were out sleeping outside. You didn't have any shelter and one thing or another. So spent a lot of time being wet.
And you were telling me one interesting story as well about you losing your greatcoat. Can you recite that for the record? You
know, well, somewhere when we were in Lark Hill, I forget where I went. I went to some kind of a dance or party or something that the... And my greatcoat was stolen, my Canadian greatcoat, great heavy... And so I went to my quartermaster, and they were out of stock. He didn't have much, so he issued me one, but it was a different one. It was a British Army greatcoat. It was quite a different cut than our Canadian greatcoat. And when I wore this on parade, and the inspecting officer come along, he would always stand in front of me and look at what in the hell is going on here. Anyway, it lasted me through the course of the war.
And so when did you first get the word that you were headed towards Italy?
Well, in, let me see, I read that in... I guess the summer of 93, September, October, somewhere around there, we knew we were going somewhere. We weren't told where we were going. But if I recollect right, we were issued semi-tropical gear shorts and lighter shirts and one thing or another. So we figured we were going south somewhere.
What would you say the general mood was in your unit after all the time in England? Were people excited to get going, or?
Oh, I guess so, yeah. We've been sitting around England for almost, 3 years, I guess, best part of 3 years. Yeah, we were happy to get on with it, too. During the first 2 years in Italy, it was a pretty bleak outlook. It was just after Dunkirk, and the Germans were flying bombers over and bombing the hell out of England, and it wasn't a very encouraging outlet. But after Pearl Harbor, the Americans came over to enter the fray, and instead of German bombers coming over on us, the big American bombers, the flying fortresses, you looked up and saw 20 of these flying over that way. The general outlook was a little more positive.
And then from England, you were shipped to North Africa?
We shipped, because of the U-boat menace in the, off the coast of France there. This was well before the invasion of France, the year before. And there were U-boat and bomber activity out there. So we went almost back. We went up out through north on the Irish Sea and almost way west. Almost back to Canada, down south, and then when we approached the Straits of Gibraltar, we were coming up from the south and the west, kind of. We were angling up, so we took a wide circuit to get there. I forget how long we were at sea, quite a while. And then we went through Gibraltar, we saw the lights of the going through at night, and then into Algiers, which was just basically a stopover, an assembly point. We went to Algiers. I remember landing at Algiers. We were all loaded up with full pack and one thing another, and we got off, and we were marching to a train station somewhere. We were all loaded up, and all these little Arab guys like this, they were volunteering to carry your packs, you see. So some of the guys that had their kit bag to one of these little guys, and well, Bingo, he disappeared down the side street somewhere.
Then I bet the officers weren't pleased about that.
Yeah, we went to another little town called Blida, which is in the news these days where all the chaos in Algeria is. No, a little town called Blida. But I can remember, it was about a two-hour train ride, I guess. And there were orange hot orchards all along the way, and the one place the train stopped, everybody been under the place. Nobody had ever seen an orange before on a tree, and I guess we hadn't seen an orange even for about 4 years. So we were then in this camp for just a few days, just mobilized, and then back to Algiers, and then on, and landed in Sicily. I could see Mount Etna, a great big mountain coming at the foot of Catania, right down. We spent, about 3 weeks or a month in Sicily, I guess, while waiting for our equipment to get assembled and one thing or another, and then on to Italy. And up to Ortona. That was where the front was at that time. This was about Christmas of 1943.
Were you actually in Ortona for Christmas?
Just after a week or two after Christmas. Things had bogged down in Ortona. The front was static there, but the Germans were there and we were here, kind of thing. And so we set up, this was the first time we had gone into operation, so we set up posts over about along Ortona's right on the coast, and then rode inland to a place called Lenciano. So we had four posts along the front there, and we observed the enemy fire or targets or whatever there was to see for about, I guess we were there for best part of 4 months, I guess. And while there was no offensive, there was this almost continuous gunfire, everybody firing at each other, and lots of skirmishes and patrol activity and one thing or another. They used to send patrols over and take prisoners if they could, and vice versa. And so there was lots of activity. But we spent full time manning the post and directing fire, we weren't part of the Monte Cassino thing when they went up and they took room, but shortly after that we went back and around and back, and the main assault started again just north of Ortona, and right up the Adriatic side, like I said, lasted from about September, I guess, right up in September of 43. September 44, and pushed the Germans right back up to the Po Valley, and this was just one battle after another. When we got to the Po Valley, what was it? Sometime around Christmas of 44, at which time they decided to pull the Canadians out of Italy and send them up. We drove back down to Marseille, to Naples, by boat to Marseille, then drove all the way up through France, where we spent a couple of weeks in Belgium, and then joined up with the Canadian forces in Nijmegen, which is where the the front again was bogged down there. And I guess this would be in January of 45. And from there on, we were part of the ongoing offensive on through Holland to, I never got into Germany, but we got the fence through Holland, and we were in Holland on VE Day. I've forgotten all the names in Holland. There was a place called Oost and, you know, Arnhem. I just remember being at Arnhem, we were posted there. But several different towns in Holland, and as I mentioned in here, we heard on our radio that the war was over on May the 5th of 1955. Well, on May the 6th, we drove through Amsterdam. And as I remarked, I have never seen such a display of such a welcome. The streets were just jammed. And of course, while we had our vehicles, everybody was jumping on the vehicles. And I've never, it was really a remarkable scene. And when we drove through, then we went up to, I don't remember the way Holland used to look like. There used to be the Zuider Zee, which was filled in while there was the peninsula up on the west side of the Zuider Zee. There was a peninsula that went up there. We were at a place called Den Helder, which was the Germans had established a naval base there. And we didn't have much to do. We were mainly to oversee the withdrawal of the Germans, but they did this on their own. We didn't interfere. They were told to get the hell out, kind of, and they assembled themselves, got together, and marched back to Germany. So we had very little to do other than to watch and say, "Keep going, you guys." I guess we were there for about a month, and then I came down with hepatitis jaundice. Almost everybody got the damn stuff. You got it from drinking dirty water, foul water, and one thing or other. And I was shipped to the hospital in Ostend in Belgium. And when I got out of there, the survey regiment had been disbanded. I don't know where the hell they went to. I never saw any of them again. I was shuffled around a little bit, and I finally ended up back in Holland and spent, I don't know how long time, 4 months there, I guess, just killing time. We didn't have anything to do, just killing time,
waiting to go home.
Waiting to go home, because there was, I don't know how many troops there were over there, 400, 600,000 or something. It took a long time to get them home. So eventually, sometime, I think it was in maybe September, end of August or September, then eventually got the call to go back to England and shipped us back on the Ile de France and back across Canada and back. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we can backpedal a little.
Yeah, sure.
Can you describe what did Ortona look like when you first arrived at the front?
Well, pretty badly shot up. But I wasn't actually at Ortona. There, as I say, there was an east-west road running inland, and I was there were four posts, Abel, Baker, Charlie, Dog. And I was, my second was Dog Charlie. I was in Dog Post, and we were, 8 miles inland, I guess, from Ortona. But Ortona itself was all shot up, but the whole front was all shot up, because there was a big battle there, and the building we were in, I got a picture of it somewhere at home, was a big old stone farmhouse right out in the open, no other buildings around. And it was all shot to hell. It was full of holes. There was no furnishings or anything left in it. It was just, but there was stone that went to the reinforced concrete, and there was hunks of concrete hanging on wires. And we occupied this for for I guess the best part of 4 months, and we had an observation post up on the top floor of the roof. So actually, the roof was all blown off, so the roof was open with a little. And we manned this for some 4 months, I guess. But our tunnel was all shot to hell. A lot of artillery fire from both sides, like the.
And what would one of your observation posts, what would it look like, generally?
What would it look like?
Mm-hmm. How many people would be there?
Well, there was about, we were divided into four groups, and we operated we looked after ourselves. We had our own, did our own cooking and one thing. The headquarters sent up rations to us, but, you know, we got a box full of food and mm-hmm. did our own cooking. There was five or six. There was a sergeant in charge, and there was five or six surveyors and people who knew how to observe the fire. There was at least one, maybe two wireless communications guy. When we were on a static front, we connected together with telephone because radio was pretty primitive, and also the Germans could hear your radio. So there we had a communications guy who was responsible for stringing the wire and maintaining it, one thing or another, although we sometimes did that. We had a guy called MT, a motor transport, whose function was to, we had two vehicles in each post, one pickup truck and an armored car kind of thing. And his responsibility was to maintain the vehicles, make sure they were in running order. He drove sometimes, but usually I drove one vehicle, and I forget who drove the other one. There might have been a couple of others there, but there was about 10 people in each post. And the way we are, the observation, the post up top was manned all the time. 24 hours a day, used to do 2 hours on and 4 off, so you gave up a lot of sleep. And while one fellow was up there, you always had one guy on duty down below, to especially at night. We never ran into any patrols, but there used to be German patrols come in, and there were also the. We were the East Indian regiments were there, the Gurkhas, and I think some other Indian regiments, as well as English troops, as well as some Canadians. A lot of the Canadians had gone back at this time. You were sitting there down there at night waiting for something to happen, and you hear somebody approach, and when these Gurkhas would stick his head in, "Tea, Johnny!" He'd want a cup of tea, and so I would talk with them and send them on their way. But that was 24-hour a day activity, and there was lots of gunfire, lots of activity. They kept busy. It was, I guess we were there when it started to warm up a little bit. The spring came, and warm weather, and we had no facilities to have a bath or anything. there was a nice beach, just south of Artona, and we would, if we get time off, and take a trip there and have a swim off the breakwater there. But basically, it was just. We were inactive. We weren't. At least we were active, but we weren't moving there. And then when I guess the I had gone through that,
you told me the other day one particularly interesting story about the Gurkhas and the way you were supposed to tie your bootlaces. Could you repeat that?
One of the functions of the we were connected, various posts were interconnected by telephone, and the artillery fire, if a shell landed close to where the wire was, it was just laid on the open ground, it would cut the wire, so you're forever patrolling. These Gurkhas were on night patrol all the time, and at that time the Germans had a habit of getting them Canadian uniforms and infiltrating, and so the Gurkhas couldn't tell whether you were Canadian or German or what the hell you were. Well, we tied our shoelaces different to the way the Germans did. We used to lace ours over and over like this, so you could cut them with a knife if you got your foot shot off or something. And you were challenged by one of these Gurkhas, and you were a Canadian, and the first thing he did, he would reach down and check your shoelaces to see whether you had them tied the right way. We were careful to make sure they were. Because these guys had pretty, they had, what did they call it? A little curved...
The kukri, the knife.
Kukri, yeah, the little curved knife, and they kept it razor sharp.
And other than trying to cut your communication lines, what other kinds of things would the Germans do to try to disrupt?
Well, mainly artillery fire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mainly artillery fire. The artillery fire was constant. There were shells coming over almost all the time.
So would you try to camouflage your observation posts as well as you could?
Oh, I couldn't camouflage. It was a great it was a great big...
great big house.
Great big stone house. When we went on to other sites, different, you tried to select your place, but, you know, sometimes it was on the open ground on a ridge, sometimes it was a building, sometimes church towers were his favorite place, but any place you could see, you tried to get on the forward side of a ridge where you could see, and whether you were close up or far back wasn't the matter. You wanted to be where you could see. But there was no point. You couldn't camouflage. You tried to keep lights going down, you sort of stuck out like a sore thumb, kind of. You know, they knew we were there. There's no doubt about that. And we used to shell obvious points. There was a few towers and one thing or another that they call up Tolo Tower and a couple of others over there that. You know damn well there was somebody up there observing you, too. Camouflage was out of the question. It was this. You didn't shine any more lights than necessary.
And you were telling me an interesting story about one close call you had when you were doing the flash and bang.
That was one. You did this to help your own observers. So you got up there and you had it equipped with a compass, and when you saw a flash, you took a bearing on it, and you timed the time between with a stopwatch, with the time between you saw the flash and the time when you heard the bang, and this gave you an indication of how far away it was. Well, I was up there doing this one night up on the open roof up on the third floor of this place, and the first shell came along and landed a few hundred feet in front of us, and another one whistled overhead and back, and I thought, oh my God, they're shooting at us, and sure enough, the third shell came, hit the big stone wall, one below me, and it threw the second floor, kind of blew a hole about like this old size. And there, and a tremendous bang, scared the shit out of me. But that was about it. No, nobody got hurt. But we were hit two or three times, and that had shells landed us around. They knew we were there, and they kept us on our toes. But we had... You always had a slit trench dug outside somewhere where any time you were engaged by fire, the thing to do was get in this trench, and you were short of a direct hit, you were pretty safe in a slit trench. Even shells land 10 feet away from you, they never hard on the ears, but.
Can you briefly explain to me, in layman's terms, the way you'd locate the enemy guns?
Well, we had four posts across the front, all surveyed in. You could plot the four posts on paper, mm-hmm. and we at each post we had an instrument that binocular type instrument we looked at with graduated and you were surveyed in, so this had you could read a bearing off it. So if you got everybody looking at the same gun, we all took a bearing to it. And then our headquarters, we phoned the information back to our headquarters, and they could plot this and locate the gun where the strings intersected. The trick was, with 50 guns all fired over there at the same time, the trick was to get everybody looking at the same gun. So what you did, they started firing. Somebody, if you have you to use, one of the posts took control. They said "flash dog," and they gave the bearing and the approximate distance. So the headquarters then told the other posts what direction to look at. And then every time you the gun would not just fire once, usually continuous fire. So every time you saw this flash, you said "flash." So that got the other guns all looking at it, and you got pretty good at this after four or five shots, you got everybody looking at the same gun, everybody got a bearing until the headquarters told you they had a good location. And while the gun was out of sight somewhere, was behind a hill somewhere, you saw at night particularly, not pretty dim in the daytime, but at night particularly you saw a flash and you took the middle of that. And we located guns with them after they'd gone. We went and checked on the locations kind of. We located guns within, 20 or 30 feet kind of thing. It was very effective. And then our disinformation, sometimes we were in direct communication with the artillery, and other times we just ferried this back to our corps headquarters and to the artillery, and depending on the policy at the time, they either engaged the fire or just recorded the information kind of. They didn't always fire back right away. They sometimes waited. They just knew that's where that gun is. But that was basically what we did. Particularly if the front was static or not moving, because you can imagine it's not very practicable to be stringing 5 miles of wire out there and setting up and surveying yourselves in. So all the way on a flexible front, when we were advancing, each post operated on its own in direct communication with an artillery officer. And we had a system, too detailed to explain how it worked, except that with a gun firing a few shots, we were able to locate ourselves relative to the gun. We knew that on a piece of paper, we could plot this to scale and say, well, they're here, and the guns are there, and the target is there. So while we didn't know where this was in space, we knew where it was, relative speaking. So having gone through this little maneuver, we could then pick out a target here, take a bearing if this was where our post was, and tell the gun what bearing and distance. I mean, the way you set a gun, you take a bearing and you crank it up, it goes either up or down, and tell them what to where to fire. And what this system did, in addition to telling them where to fire, it took account of the error in the gun. I mean, you aim a gun somewhere and you shoot at something, but it doesn't hit there, it hits over here, kind of, you know, it's a scattered thing. Well, this system took account of the error or the effect of the wind in one thing or another. So once you picked a target, it was pretty good. We could sometimes come bang on, and if it wasn't, the gun would engage the target, and we could observe where the shells landed, assuming that it was visible, like, you could observe where their shells landed and give them a correction, you know, if they were 100 yards to the right or something, we'd give them a correction to, and we did this in direct contact with the artillery, and this only took a sort of an hour to set up, kind of thing, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours maybe at the most, but it, you know, and it didn't involve it was much simpler, a little more sophisticated in the way it operated. In addition to that, we calibrated the guns when they fired them. As I say, we should took when they say they're going to fire 5,000 yards, it doesn't go 5,000 yards, so we gave them corrections, calibrated the guns, and did all sorts of exercise with the guns. And in addition, one of our separate batteries, the survey battery, they actually carried survey forward and surveyed in the guns. They provided surveyor for the guns. But that was basically what our activities.
You said that when you were heading out to Italy, you were issued gear for a tropical climate. Did you find that was sufficient for the conditions in Italy?
We just had shorts and light shirts and one thing and another. I guess I commented on the other clothing. By today's standards, the stuff you find in a typical outdoor shop now, the army equipment back then, the army clothing back then, was pretty heavy and pretty basic.
But it worked.
I commented on the wedge caps, I think, and on the stupid caps they still wear now. Why the hell they don't give them a decent hat, I don't know.
And what about you? We're saying that in Holland you were greeted very enthusiastically by the Dutch. Did you have any interactions with Italians? Italian civilians?
Some, yeah, not a lot, because usually they had got the hell out of the road of Canada. Yeah, we had a fair amount, and initially the Italians were the enemy. Well, after the Germans treated the Italians very badly. Well, when they were backing up, you know, they took all the provisions and looted all the wine, and so their attitude had changed. They didn't have much use for the Germans, and they welcomed us. One thing there was quite a group of called partisans who were undermining the Germans. Well, almost everybody was a partisan, whether they were or not. You know, the young fellows, 15 and 18, and they were declaring themselves partisans, going around and. Quite a few of them blew themselves up with them going around poking around where they shouldn't, because there was a lot of landmines and booby traps and one thing and another. But by and large, the Italians, they were glad to see us, but it was under harsh conditions. So we had a few times we were back and mixed with the, but not a whole lot of contact with them.
Let's go back to the booby traps. You were saying that you had, or there was issues with booby traps. Can you explain that a bit more?
The would be traps and mines. You know, all along the roadways, they would put mines in there, and some of them were, you had mine detectors, but they were starting to use plastic mines and one thing or another, and so you had to be watched for that. But also they would put booby traps, some kind of mine, something that would trigger off if you touched it or stepped on it or any place where they thought they might. One of the things you do as we went forward, the Germans always had themselves well dug in with holes 6 feet deep, you know. Well, there was a tendency for, if you were advancing and you got to where their holes were, you may as well use them rather than digging your own kind of thing. And you had to be damn careful there, because they would put some kind of a booby trap in there. And we had several people who either got killed or blew a leg off or something from booby traps. It was an ongoing threat. And you didn't hold a... You couldn't always identify them, you know. You'd see some strange-looking object on the wall, and we weren't bomb disposal experts, so you call somebody in. I don't know what the hell this is here, but it was an ongoing threat, an ongoing problem.
You also told me one army urban legend, if you will, about an exploding toilet.
Well, we heard this story about somewhere in North Africa, where one of these toilets up above, where I forget, one of the officers went to the toilet and pulled the string and blew the whole place up. That's just a story we'd heard, that warning.
How did you feel leaving Italy for Holland? Were you sad to leave before the campaign was done?
Oh no, I guess we were. We were quite. You know, it was a new adventure, kind of. We were quite excited, and also it was a bit of a tour. Sam and France had been liberated at this time, so we went down to Marseille and. On an American troop ship, I guess it was, loaded our vehicles on, and then drove up all the way through France, which was a sightseeing tour in a way. And
was the war the first time you'd been out of Canada?
Well, I'd been to the States a couple of times, but about the first time I'd been out of Canada. Yeah, we were happy to go, and took it in there. You did what you were told to do. didn't question it. You could kind of see the end. The invasion of Normandy had taken place, and they'd got as far as Belgium and all that kind of there. There was they bogged down a bit then, but we could kind of see the bloody thing was going to finish sometime in the not too distant future.
Did you find conditions in Holland to be that different from Italy, or were you just doing your...
Well, it was a different country, different topography, flat. The end of the campaign pretty hectic. It was the Germans didn't give up easy there in the last. I can remember one incident was kind of interesting. We said we were before they'd taken Arnhem, which what the hell's the river? It's not the Rhine. It's another river. The Arnhem was across the river, and it hadn't been taken yet. We've set up a post that there was a river with dikes on either side, and then the town of Armour, and we set up a post in a farmhouse here with red tile roof kind of thing. Well, we moved in there at night, went up to the attic, and took a couple of tiles off, and were observing through this weather instrument, you know. Well, I was up there on duty on at about daybreak, I guess, and there was a dike on this side, and then the river, and then another dike, and then the town of Armand up in the hill. Well, I was looking there, and well, they go to hell, and looking across it, it wasn't that far away, about, I don't know, 600-700 yards, and I could see something shining back at me, so somebody else was. And so I went out in the morning. I went out in front, but you could do this because you weren't you were protected by the dike. They couldn't see, like you see. So I looked up at this bloody tile we'd taken off the roof, like you see, and it stuck out like a sore thumb too. Well, sure enough, around about noon, they pulled up. They had mobile 88 guns. They pulled up one of these and they started. We vacated them. We said the hell with it. We took and they put a shell right through the roof and blew our instruments and everything all to hell. And nobody was hurt because we had gone and gotten the slit rates. But that was one little episode at Armand. But shortly after that, it all folded up. I forget where we were. We were up. They'd taken Armand. Some place called Aberdoon, I think. We were heard a notice on the radio in the morning that the Germans had sued for surrender. So we didn't have anything to drink. So it was we were glad that it was over.
You were saying that after the war, your unit was in charge of making sure the Germans withdraw. Did you actually get a chance to talk with any of the
Germans? Oh, no, we didn't. No, we didn't fraternize. We were told not to. We didn't interfere with them at all. We just stayed back. They were in a... there was a big naval base there, and they just... You saw them. Bedraggled groups of infantry marching back to Germany. But the one place we did have contact was in Italy. And one place on the campaign up the up the Adriatic coast, and the strategy, Montgomery's strategy, was to use heavy artillery barrages. They would get as many guns as they could assemble. You know, for 200 or 300 guns, kind of thing, and continuous fire at the enemy lines, and then this would get pretty panicky for somebody on the, you know, you get your head down and shells bursting around you for hours on end. At one place, this platoon of Germans, and we were in an observation post there, and we saw this platoon of Germans come up waving a white flag, and they were looking for something to give themselves up to. Well, they come up, and then they were led. There was two young officers there, but they were the typical. I don't know if you watch any of these World War II movies. They were the typical cocksure Nazi bastards. Come along, and they were trying to tell us that sure they had to surrender now, but there was a great German flotilla which was going to land back somewhere in Rome somewhere and cut us all off, you know. But anyway, we weren't there. They were trying to surrender. Well, you can't give yourselves in to us. We took their all their rifles and arms. I mean, they did not rifles. They had machine guns, 20 guns, and we took that. So, well, keep on going and find yourself some military police somewhere, and they'll look after you. But it was kind of funny. They were trying to BS us that we were about to be surrounded at any minute.
I'm sure they would have liked to believe that.
But we didn't have a lot of contact with
And I think we're nearing the end of our interview, but one last thing to touch on. When you came home, you were met by your parents?
Yeah, I met by my parents.
What was their reaction to see you after 6 years?
Well, they were pretty glad to see us, because we hadn't seen them for 5 years or more. Yeah, they were pretty glad to see us, and we were pretty glad to be home.
I can imagine.
And, that was, took a little getting used to being home out of the Army, not having somebody telling you where to go and what to do kind of all the time. You had to start making your own, calling your own shots, and I stayed around home for, two or three months, I guess, and they didn't discharge you right away. You had to come back to Vancouver to get discharged, and we have a medical and one thing another decide whether you were all in one piece still. As I think I mentioned to you, when you were discharged, you were given two or three options. You could either continue your education, they'd provide you with mortgage assistance to acquire a house, or they'd help you to start a little business. So I leapt at the opportunity to go back to university, and when we started at Christ, of course we started to Christmas and got 1 year in between Christmas and July kind of, and then started again in August. So I got the 4 years in, and I had 1 year in already, and got the additional 4 years in and three and a half, and graduated in 1949, I guess. I think we had a reunion about 30 years later. I was in North Van at the time, and it was funny to see people, because you got pretty close to some of these guys in there. We were in separate posts, and a lot of the time we were on our own, looking after ourselves, like in a separate kind of a place. So I was with some of the same guys for, 3 or 4 years, I guess. So you got to know these guys pretty well. Well, it was kind of funny seeing about 30 years later, you know, somebody you hadn't seen for this, because I never kept in touch with anybody. Most of them were from down east, you see. There were only two or three out here that I knew out. I never, I was happy to forget about it all and get on with life, and I never bothered with joining the Legion or their, my list. I can't remember all the medals we got. I never got any Distinguished Service Awards or anything like that, but we got a whole collection of medals for the various campaigns you ran. You got one for being in the full 5 years, the 1939-45 Star, one for being a volunteer, the Canadian Volunteer Service Medal, and CLASP. I'm not sure what the hell the CLASP was for. I think you got a third one. I forgot now. I think I got 6 or 7 medals. I got still on my bottom drawer somewhere. This was one for overseas, one for Italy, and one for the Northeast Europe. No, it seems to me it's Northwest, but it's no Europe anyway. So I think there were 7 medals in all that. These were just campaign medals to indicate that they didn't. I don't. Not too many people got to, in our outfit, got mentioned in dispatches. My brother was in the Provo Corps, and he got blown up in a jeep, ran over a mine or something. Got one, but anyway, he got the Belgium Croix de Guerre or something. Not sure what he did to her, but just got blown up, I guess. That was the main thing.
And one last quick question. I'm curious. You said you had problems in your unit, but just in general, with jaundice and hepatitis. Were there any other real health problems that Canadians had issues with, either in Holland or Italy?
Well, one, when we're on our way up to our tournament to start, we stayed in a I don't know where we just suspect this came from. We stayed up in a huge barn, up in a loft, and there were goats or sheep or some damn thing down below. Well, I don't know where it came from. Somebody thinks it came from, but the whole bloody works of us came down with a real dose of the flu. A lot of guys got sent back. I can remember laying on the floor half dead kind of thing with the bloody flu, but they could only send so many back to hospital, so I had to stay and tough it out. But everybody got the flu, and a lot of people had to go back to hospital. But there wasn't any particular health problem. There was, of course, a fair number got VD of one description or another, had to go to lots of accidents, lots of motorcycle accidents. There's wards and wards full of drivers or motorcycle drivers who'd cracked up because they were used to travel in convoys. You see, a whole regiment, there would be maybe 60 vehicles all in convoy, and there would be a what's called a driver rider or something, two or three motorcycle guys running up and down the length of this convoy to sort of keep things in order. Well, one of the problems with a convoy that was doing this all the time on the front, you were supposed to keep a 300-foot space or something between vehicles, depending on how fast you were going. But when the front one stopped for some reason or other, everything would squeeze up like this, and then they'd take off. So it was all like this, and the motorcycle drivers were, you know, they were coming close up, kind of slow down. but there wasn't any particular health problem. I think each unit had its own MO, military officer, and a doctor usually, and we had one, what we call him, Take It Easy Sam. You go there, have an aspirin, take it easy kind of thing. The dental services were pretty iffy. You know, once in a while, I still got all my teeth, but I had two or three guys. I came down with the German measles or something. I mean, once you're growing up, it hits you pretty hard. I had an awful fever. So they sent me to a little separate British hospital there somewhere, fever hospital. There was only two patients, me and some guy who had meningitis or something, so he was kept, I kept away from him. So I was there for a couple of weeks. And the hospitals were good. So
And what about did you have a field medic along with you in your observation post in case were shelled?
Or? No.
What would you do if someone was injured? Did you ever run into that?
You hit a little thing at a post called a first field dressing.
Mm-hmm.
Under no circumstance. I think this... it seems to me we had access to morphine or something, and under no circumstances were you to ever use this, unless you were injured. But you know, there was nowadays. I mean, the first thing somebody would do was taking this out and taking the morphine. You know, the other thing we had. A little thing they had on the other side, the emergency rations. It was sort of dried nuts and chocolate, some, you know, high protein stuff. And this again was in a little packet that you had stuffed somewhere in your uniform. And again, under no circumstance any time you had to, you got inspected, you had to be able to produce your first field dressing in your. But no, we didn't have a. I guess this thing had bandages in it and one thing, another thing, got hurt.
Enough to get them in good enough condition to get them to the medic.
But no, we didn't have. We had. There was a medical officer back at headquarters somewhere, so you could. You could get hauled back and
All right, well, Stan, that's all the questions I had for you, unless do you have anything you'd like to add?
I can tell you a little story about the Sergeant Major. I can tell you two stories.
Sure.
About Sergeant Major, a regiment is made up of three batteries, mm-hmm. and there's a battery Sergeant Major. He's the senior non-commissioned officer, like you see, and then there's the regimental Sergeant Major, who's the. And Sergeant Majors usually got selected because they had a big booming voice, like you see. But anyway, when we were going overseas, this was a big secret. We landed somewhere up in Scotland on the Clyde, but we took our Canadian shoulder patches off, and everybody used to smoke Sweet Caporal cigarettes, which were Canadian cigarettes. Under those circumstances where you do have any cigarette packages, you would keep a big dark secret that we were Canadians.
And why was that?
Well, we tried to keep it a secret so that, loose tongues cost lives kind of thing.
Right.
Under no circumstances were we to reveal where we came from. So when we landed in Greenock on the Cloud and on the Clyde River, and we came, the ships couldn't land. They unloaded you with tenders, and we were standing on the train platform, I guess. And the regimental sergeant major, we were all lined up, and at the top of his voice, he stands up and bawls out, "First Canadian Survey Regiment, attention!" So he announced to half of Scotland who the hell we were. But the other little episode was the sergeant major, or battery sergeant major. He was he was a great guy, but he was a pompous little bastard, kind of, and when you all, one place we were, you'd line up on parade in the morning, and he'd be out in front there, and there was a little hummock, kind of, little hill there. Well, he used to stand on top of this, and it'd kind of give him more stature, you see, and he would call, and then he'd turn it over to the officer, you see. Well, one night, some of them, a bunch of them got out, and we scraped this bomb down level. Well, he came out in the morning, and he walked out there, and he was walking around there looking for his mound. Everybody burst out laughing there. So there were amusing little incidents like that that you look back on. When we were... spent a lot of time waiting for something to happen. When we were on our way overseas, we landed in Halifax, and we all, and this was the whole regiment, and we were in a great bloody big warehouse waiting to board ship with all our full pack and one thing and another sitting there waiting, and then somewhere somebody started to the tune of the well-known Anglican hymn, "Holy, Holy, Holy," started off singing, "Waiting, waiting, waiting, always bloody well waiting." And suddenly the whole 400, 300 men all started. That's when the booming and they, it was like the great chorus of the Victoria Symphony all singing this. And these little things kind of stand out in your mind. Nothing happened. We didn't get on any faster. But it was just
helped pass
it was
the
quite
time.
Something to see about 300 men all singing together there. It was booming and echoing through the... but anyway, that's about it.
All right, well, in that case, I'll give you your copy of the release form. I have a pen for you as well.
How's it going? Is it nearly over?
Yeah, we're just finishing up now.
Oh, good. I'll make a cup of tea and have a drink before you...
You want me to sign here?
Yep, there, and signature there, and print there.
Wow, that went pretty good, did it? Or
oh, it went great.
Fine. You wrote out quite a bit last night. I said, what are you writing, a book? I guess that helps, though, eh? Oh, here. Just going in.
Well, I'll tear these out and give them to you.
All right, now Stan, we've both signed the release forms. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, I've got nothing to hide.
True gentleman. Well, in that case then, this concludes the UVic Military Oral History Program with Stan Oakes on Wednesday, the 26th of January.